Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, at a time when so many are out of work, why are there staff shortages at long-term care facilities? But up front, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you. Most of us recognize the Miranda warning given to those accused of or arrested for committing a crime, either from TV, movies, or maybe experienced it ourselves. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled more than five decades ago that the accused had to be informed of their constitutional rights before speaking to police or others in law enforcement. However, crime victims have no such constitutional rights in Pennsylvania. That's what Marcy's Law was designed to do, provide constitutionally guaranteed rights to crime victims. It passed two sessions of the legislature and was approved by voters in a referendum in November 2019. But earlier this month, Commonwealth Court struck down that vote, saying voters were asked to consider too many changes at once, which is unconstitutional in Pennsylvania. Joining us on this portion of today's program is Jen Riley, the State Director of Marcy's Law for Pennsylvania, and Jennifer Storm, Pennsylvania's victim advocate. Jen Riley, what was Marcy's Law designed to do?
Sure. So Marcy's Law is an effort to elevate crime victims' rights to state constitutions in order to make those rights enforceable. So without constitutional rights, crime victims can go throughout the criminal justice process without having those rights afforded to them, and there's nothing they can do. There's no recourse.
Crime victims already have those rights, but they are in statute rather than in the Pennsylvania Constitution, right?
That's correct. So the rights that are included in Marcy's Law are already in statute. The problem is that every day we hear about victims whose rights have been violated, and because they don't have standing within the courtroom, there's nothing they can do. So it's a right without a remedy. So imagine having the right to do something, but if it's violated, you're kind of stuck out there in the cold. There's nothing you can do. It's not right for crime victims. It's stripping them of their voice, especially when they've been through such a horrific, most often life-altering crime.
Now, just to be clear, what Commonwealth Court struck down was the wording of this question, that they said there was too many things for voters to consider. In fact, the lawsuit was brought by the Pennsylvania League of Women Voters, not exactly a radical group. Jennifer Storm, let me read the question that voters approved in November 2019. Shall the Pennsylvania Constitution be amended to grant certain rights to crime victims, including to be treated with fairness, respect, and dignity, considering their safety in all bail proceedings, timely notice, and opportunity to take part in public proceedings, reasonable protection from the accused, right to refuse discovery request made by the accused, restitution and return of property, proceedings free from delay, and to be informed of these rights so they can enforce them. I have to say, Jennifer, that's a lot to consider for a voter.
So it's obviously victims' rights. We're talking about the subject of victims having rights. And if you look to the statute, those are all the existing rights that they have. So it's essentially just picking those rights up and putting them in the Constitution. And we're limited by Pennsylvania, the rules in terms of modifying the Constitution. You can only have a certain number of words in your ballot question. And so we felt that the ballot question was fair. It was drafted within the Department of State and with the Attorney General. And Attorney General Josh Shapiro has been an incredible supporter of Marcy's Law and continues to be. And they were able to add what's called a plain English statement that ran in every newspaper across the Commonwealth just to educate individuals on exactly what does that mean, right? What is those 75 words that we are limited to, that anyone who wants to amend the Constitution is limited to, what does that mean? We think the Attorney General did a phenomenal job with the plain English statement, and 1.7 million Pennsylvanians agreed. It was a huge voter get, and people get it. And I think, Scott, something you said in the beginning about people understanding Miranda rights, right? It's something, because it's in the Constitution, because we hear about it so often, people know exactly what those are. The reason we wanted to bring Marcy's Law and bring constitutional rights to Pennsylvania is because still today there are so many victims and family members of homicide survivors that don't understand that they even have rights. And then they come into a system only to be told, yeah, you have rights, but they're not enforceable, so good luck.
If you have a question or a comment, like to weigh in our conversation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. But Jennifer Storm, I just wanted to follow up a little bit with that. Now, granted, I feel like we're debating something that happened over a year ago with this vote, but the court ruling just came down just a little over two weeks ago. What if a voter agreed with most of what the questions that were being asked there, but not all? What would they be able to do other than just say yes or no? I mean, say they, I think the Supreme Court said that, or the ACLU has said there's like 15 questions there. If they agreed with 10 of them, but five of them, well, maybe I'm not so sure of, but 10 to five, I'm going to vote yes.
I mean, I guess I would say these are already existing rights. So essentially then you would be wanting to backtrack for victims' rights. If you look at what was presented in the 75 words, these are rights that already are living and breathing on the books for crime victims today. So a vote against that would be to diminish existing victims' rights. And I would say that that's deeply problematic, because these rights have been on the books for a reason. They have, in effect, given victims at least a role statutorily in the justice system. And so to take one of these rights away would be literally doing just that. You would be removing an existing right for a victim. What we're just trying to do is elevate them to the Constitution so that victims actually can assert their rights in court, that their rights can actually be acknowledged and valued.
Generally, was there any thought put to maybe making it multiple questions on the ballot rather than just one?
Yeah, so we're getting to this concept of single subject, right, which is at the heart of the ACLU's argument against Marcy's Law. And it's really a technical argument. And, our Constitution has a provision that each amendment needs to be about a single subject. Now, if you look at the First Amendment of our Constitution talks about five different rights: press, assembly, petition, religion, speech. I mean, all of these things relate to a single subject, freedom, right? And so they're sufficiently interrelated. Now, with Marcy's Law, all of the things within Marcy's Law, as Jennifer said, are sufficiently interrelated to victims' rights. And to say that they're not, again, like Jen said, is to backtrack rights, but then also to basically work in lockstep with criminal defense attorneys to try to strip away rights from victims, try to remove them from the courtroom and silence their voice. And we just can't stand for that.
Jennifer Storm, do you know of occasions where victims, crime victims, their families have not been made aware of the statutory rights that they have?
Yes. Every day. And that's part of a precipice to bring Marcy's Law to Pennsylvania. For decades in Pennsylvania, even my predecessor, Kara Lavery, there was research being done. There was focus groups with victims and survivors. The Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape, the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence, PCCD, have done study after study and needs assessment after needs assessment into Pennsylvanians, asking them, do you know that you have rights as a crime victim? And it kept coming back that A, no, people didn't understand and know that there were rights. And then B, the ones that did go through this system had rights that were significantly violated. My office, the Office of Victim Advocate, has a compliance department where we collect stories, and we, you know, we don't have any enforcement. So there's not a whole lot we can do with the story except reach out to the offending party and say, hey, you know, can you help this victim? If it's something that was done in the past, there isn't a whole lot we can do, but we have file after file after file. And each and every one of those files is a victim who should have been centrally placed in the case that was left to the side or kicked out of the courtroom, as Jen indicated. And yeah, we hear it every day.
Jen Riley, you know, I read the question, but these, if you look at it, drill down a little bit on the individual questions, what rights or what information should crime victims or their families be getting that, you know, to inform them that they do have rights?
Right. So within Marcy's Law, well, Marcy's Law basically creates, you know, the constitutional protections that victims are given these their rights and making sure that they're aware of their rights at every step. And that starts with law enforcement. That's then that continues into the, you know, the prosecuting phase, and then all the way to Jennifer Storm's office, the Office of Victim Advocate, where victims are notified of their post-conviction rights. So, you know, there's a lot of different rights that go throughout the system for crime victims. And unfortunately, this lawsuit is trying to strip away those rights or diminish them in some way, especially at a time where, as a society, we need to be recognizing that victims should have a voice in the courtroom. And instead of falling back to the criminal defense attorney's argument that they should be removed.
Let me bring up some other issues. The number of questions is what Commonwealth Court struck down, or, you know, the totality of what voters had to consider at the vote. But the ACLU has raised other issues with this. And again, I feel like we are going back and talking about the pre-vote debate about Marcy's Law. But some of the things that have been said about Marcy's Law, criticisms of it, is that it would undermine the rights of people accused of crimes, primarily due process and the presumption of innocence, because it would strengthen government's power against defendant. What they've said is that constitutional rights to exist to protect individuals from government overreach in a criminal case, the state is attempting to deprive the accused, not the victim, of life, liberty, and property, is why defendants' rights must be constitutionally enshrined and not victims' rights. Jennifer Storm, your thoughts on that?
Well, there's a couple things to unpack there, right? I think it's very clear where the ACLU stands, and they stand firmly behind the offender. And they've made that very clear. One of their initial arguments is that we shouldn't even call victims victims, right? And we're seeing that being highlighted in the Aubrey case right now, where we had this individual murdered, and now you've got savvy defense attorneys saying, well, we don't even want to call him a victim in his own criminal trial, which is unconscionable. And here's what I would say, that victims are also at the mercy of government. When their rights are not their own, when they have to be presented to them through other parties, such as the district attorney, law enforcement, the prisons, probation and parole, et cetera, they are also at the mercy of government. Do they not have the same value? Do we not value victims enough to say your rights matter so much that we're going to place them in the Constitution, we're going to protect them enough that we enforce them so government can't overreach into your space either and violate your right? I actually think it's the opposite. It's the way we argue victims deserve to have equal protection under law, and they should be placed in the Constitution.
But that argument that they make, that a victim's freedom is not being taken away, how do you respond to that?
I'm not really sure what they mean by victim's freedom. There are so many rights delineated in the Constitution for a person who's accused of a crime. And the rights that we're asserting for victims that are already on the books do not confront those rights. There are 35 states in the country that have victims' rights on the books, Arizona being the oldest that has constitutional protections on the books they've had, in my belief, since the 70s. There is not one single case law, and I've asked the ACLU time and time again, show me a piece of case law that says a victim's constitutional right somehow, you know, it took away a freedom or somehow took away a right of the accused, and they can't show me one because it doesn't happen. The rights are there's equal protection, but the rights are very different and they're unique to the circumstances.
Scott,
I'd just like to add too that this lawsuit is basically manipulative. I mean, the hypotheticals that the ACLU puts in their response, they're just manipulative. None of these things happen, as Jennifer Storm says. In addition, it's also anti-democratic. You know, we're talking about 74% of voters that voted for this, and just because the ACLU disagrees that victims should have rights, they are trying to say that Marcy's Law is unconstitutional. And we went through all of the legislative process, the voters agreed, everyone has agreed, the ACLU has lost every public and private debate on this, and now they are doing what they do, and they are lawyering up, and they are trying to deny victims their rights.
Jen Riley, will this decision be appealed?
Yes, we always knew that this decision would be going to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, so we've always been prepared for that. So Marcy's Law and our advocates and the victims and survivors that are standing behind us, we're willing to go all the way on this. And it's not something that we're going to back down from. We're not going to be intimidated by hypothetical doomsday scenarios that the ACLU purports with Marcy's Law. I mean, these are lives. These are victims that have been raped and murdered. And we're just not gonna stand down to this type of bullying.
Has a case, as Jennifer Storm mentioned, 35 other states have Marcy's Law stipulations. Has the U.S. Supreme Court ever ruled or weighed in on any of those cases or in other states?
So there is one thing. So you mentioned earlier, Scott, how the ACLU says that that somehow Marcy's Law infringes upon due process for defendants because of, you know, the right to refuse discovery requests made by the defendants. And that has been very clearly spelled out by the United States Supreme Court, that the right to confront witness means cross-examination within the courtroom. And what Marcy's Law is trying to protect with that specific provision within it is the ability for defendants representing themselves to go to a victim's household and harass them for a deposition. And that happens. And we hear from other states where that happens. That's not allowed here in Pennsylvania. So that's the reason why that provision is within Marcy's Law. So these, again, doomsday scenarios and hypotheticals that are within the ACLU's lawsuit are just not based in any fact there, and they're just manipulative.
If anything, Jen, just to jump on that, the Supreme Court of the United States has been very clear on one of the prime issues that the ACLU has taken with our version of Marcy's Law, and that is that there is no constitutional right to pretrial discovery.
I want to change subjects for just a moment. Jennifer Storm, speaking of constitutional votes, the Pennsylvania House voted 187-15 yesterday on a constitutional amendment to open a 2-year window for child sexual abuse survivors to file civil claims against their abusers. This is something that you have fought long and hard for. Your thoughts on what happened in the House yesterday, and now it moves ahead, and voters may consider this constitutional amendment as well.
Yep. So we're happy that the House kind of put this as one of their first agenda items. I spoke with Senator Baker. She plans on doing the same in the Senate. So we do believe that this measure will go to ballot rather quickly. And then the voters will have an opportunity to decide. Listen, it's going to be a long battle. A lot of survivors know that. But they're excited that there's at least mechanisms that are starting to move forward. It doesn't cover all victims. So there's a lot of survivors and victims that are left out of this. This provision is very clearly only for child victims. So we've got so many 18, 19, 20, 30, 40, 50-year-old survivors that are saying, well, what about me? This has nothing to do with me. So we still have a long way to go, but it is certainly progress, and we're really excited to see the momentum.
So what does that legislation say?
It essentially says that if you are a child victim of sexual assault, what it does is it allows for that the provision in the Constitution that has been wildly debated, that many of us believe is not a barrier to passing just legislation to open the window like every other state has done. However, it basically is saying that they're going to suspend this provision in the Constitution that would disallow this kind of retroactive window, and then they're going to allow the opening of that window. But it's very specific that it's only for victims who are 18 18 or under when they were sexually assaulted. So it leaves out a huge portion of survivors and victims that still to this day have no recourse, have no ability to get deposition, to get evidence and facts in their own case, and to really hold institutions accountable who harmed them egregiously.
Jen Riley is the state director of Marcy's Law for Pennsylvania. Jen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
And Jennifer Storm, Pennsylvania's victim advocate. Jennifer, we've spoken very often over the last few years, and tomorrow is your last day as Pennsylvania's victim advocate. And I know there are very many crime victims out there that would thank you for the job that you've done over the years. But always enjoyed talking to you. You've always been very forthcoming and provided a lot of great information for the people of Pennsylvania. Jennifer, thank you very much for being with us today as well.
Thank you, Scott. You're always one of my favorite interviews to do, so it feels very right that I'm ending my last interview with you, and just appreciate your willingness to tackle these tough topics all the time. So thank
you. Where do you go from here?
I'm going to do some consulting work, and I'm going to stay squarely in victims' rights and victim services because this is where my heart and soul is. And so it's very bittersweet. I love the work that I've done. I love the individuals that I've worked with. If I could rewrite this, I would stay, right? But it wasn't really mine 100% to decide. But I do, I'm excited about what's next. And I, like I said, I'm going to stay squarely in supporting victims and advocating for victims' rights.
Well, good luck, Jen. Thank you very much for being with us and all the times you've been on the show in the past. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're going to continue our conversation now on Marcy's Law. The American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania opposed Marcy's Law, arguing in court the referendum question put to voters wasn't constitutionally succinct and asked voters to consider too many changes, but the ACLU had some other issues with Marcy's Law as well. Joining us now is Stephen Bizarre. He was the lead counsel for the ACLU in this case. Mr. Bizarre, thank you very much for being with us today. One thing that our previous guest, said about that question that was asked of voters in November of 2019, that 74% of the people voted for. They say it was easy to understand. 74% of the people understood it and approved it. Your response to that?
So a couple things, Scott. First of all, good morning. I'm not counsel for the ACLU. I'm counsel for the League of Women Voters and Lorraine Haw. Those are the petitioners and the plaintiffs in this case. The ACLU is my co-counsel in this matter. And of course, they did oppose Marcy's Law during the legislative process, and they continue to oppose it. So I want to go back to the premise that you raised, which is the notion that 74% of people supported Marcy's Law. That's really not exactly accurate. The November 2019 election saw 23% of electors, 23% of voters voted. That was the turnout. And of those voters, 74% voted in support of Marcy's Law, which is really not the enormous turnout you would expect given the tremendous lobbying effort, Kelsey Grammer and others lobbying on behalf of the amendment. So that's number one. But the issue here, Scott, the fundamental issue is not voters who voted for Marcy's Law, but the process by which the voters were presented with the amendment. The Constitution in Pennsylvania really allows for it to be amended in two ways. We can have a constitutional convention, or we can have the amendment process that's spelled out in the Constitution, which means that when you present different issues or different subjects to the voters, they have to vote on them separately. And the problem with Marcy's Law, and I think your questions to Ms. Storm and Ms. Riley really illustrated this, the problem with Marcy's Law is that there were 500 words in the amendment, in the proposed amendment. It affected about a dozen constitutional provisions, but the voters only got to vote yes or no. It was like they didn't have the opportunity to present their vote on the particular amendments that they supported and vote against the particular amendments that they didn't support. And that is a fundamental violation of the Constitution. And it was found to be so at the preliminary injunction stage and then at the Supreme Court when that was appealed and then again at the Commonwealth Court on the merits.
So speaking of merits then, representing the League of Women Voters, Did the League of Women Voters oppose this solely on the question itself or on the intent of that constitutional amendment?
Yeah, the League of Women Voters is not against victims' rights, and I don't think the ACLU is against victims' rights. As the victims' rights advocates noted, and as you noted, there are victims' rights provided for by statute, no one here is trying to stop helping victims. The legislature in Pennsylvania could act tomorrow to enforce the rights of victims to get notice of court proceedings that affect them, to fully fund compensation for victims, to be sure that they get restitution before the government collects fines or costs. You don't need a constitutional amendment to do any of that. What we need to have happen is for the law enforcement officials who are very happy to pile on criminal defendants, we need to have those law enforcement officials actually enforce the laws that exist to protect victims and to prioritize compensation for victims. If the police and the district attorneys aren't honoring the rights that exist now, the rights for crime victims now, what makes anyone think that they're going to honor those rights if there's a constitutional amendment?
Well, because it's constitutional. I mean, that's if the constitutional says so. I mean, rather than statute, I think that something that is written into the Pennsylvania Constitution carries more weight than something that is maybe written in statute that they are not going by.
Well, that's the fundamental premise from the other side of the case, right? That the Constitution will allow the victims themselves to stand up for them, for their own rights, which presumes that they will, that they're not so traumatized that they will be willing to stand up. But I think we should be holding our legislators and our elected officials and our law enforcement officials responsible for protecting the constituents that they are supposed to protect. That's really what should be done. And frankly, if they want to amend the Constitution to give victims a constitutional voice, they can do that, but they have to follow the procedure set forth in the Constitution to accomplish it. And that means letting the voters decide which amendments they actually support and which they don't.
Well, getting back to your, I don't want to get into a debate about turnout and that kind of thing, but let's face it, in what often are referred to as off-year elections when we're not electing a president or a governor here in Pennsylvania, the turnout is usually low. 23% is probably average for that, maybe even a little bit above it. I'm not sure. But 23% of those who did vote, 74% of those 23% did say, I mean, that's an overwhelming majority. I mean, there are those who would say that what you're saying, and I think Jen Riley brought this up, that you're disenfranchising voters who said that, yes, this is something we want to see in Pennsylvania's Constitution. Three quarters of the people who voted for it said, yes, we want to see that. But you're saying they couldn't understand it.
We're saying that it wasn't presented to them in the way that the Constitution requires it to be presented. I think we have to go back and remember that when the Constitution is not followed, the rights of all voters and all citizens are affected. And so we're really trying to protect the constitutional process for amending the People's Organic Charter here. It's really a conservative process. The Constitution doesn't envision presenting voters with 15 amendments all packaged in one under one category. It envisions the voters having to vote on separate amendments separately to have them be presented. And so we certainly challenge the proposed amendment as not being fair to the voters because the 73 words that were contained in the ballot question that you read didn't adequately capture the 500 words in the amendment. And that's the issue. The voters may have voted for it, but it was an invalid and unconstitutional ballot question. That's what the courts have found three times now, both at the preliminary injunction stage on appeal from the preliminary injunction, and then again on the merits at the Commonwealth Court most recently.
Maybe I'm asking you to advocate for Marcy's Law here when I ask this question, but how should it have been placed on the ballot? I mean, Pennsylvania's Constitution, it says, has to be 75 words or less. There are multiple subjects, as you've mentioned. How should it have been placed on the ballot?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I think it needs to be placed on the ballot, given that there is a Crime Victims Act on the statute books that needs to be enforced. And it's not for me to say how the legislature should do its job. They're perfectly capable of it. But the key point I would make is that the Constitution requires that when separate questions are presented or separate changes to the Constitution are being presented, they have to be presented separately. So when you have an amendment that in one instance gives victims a right to be heard at the bail hearing, and in another instance, it has gives them the right to prompt restitution, those two issues are not sufficiently interrelated that they should be presented at the same time. And so the constitutional amendment process really requires that the voters be given each question separately so that they can decide which ones they support and which ones they don't.
You know, representing the League of Women Voters, the League of Women Voters is an organization that one of the leading organizations in the state for voters' rights. When, you know, Jen Riley, I think, said that you've disenfranchised these voters who voted for this. How do you respond to that?
I don't really think that the question that was presented to the voters was a fair question, and the courts have agreed three times so far. And I'm fairly confident that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is going to come out the same way as well. I think that no one's trying to disenfranchise the voters, but it's the responsibility of organizations like the League of Women Voters, and frankly, like the ACLU, to make sure that these processes are followed and obeyed so that the Constitution is protected, because any degradation of the Constitution, whether it's the state Constitution or, as we've seen more recently, the U.S. Constitution, is a threat to all of us. And we can't stand for that. And we're actually quite fortunate to have organizations like the League of Women Voters that are willing to take on unpopular causes to protect all of our rights.
As you said, Mr. Bizarre, you do not represent the ACLU, but the ACLU, one of the things that they have said about this is it undermines the rights of people accused of crimes, due process, presumption of innocence, that it, you know, criminal defendants are given more rights, but because they could lose their freedom, there's more at stake here. Does the League of Women Voters subscribe to that as well, or is that just the ACLU argument?
I think you really said it very well, Scott, so I commend you for it. When someone is accused of crime, there is a presumption of innocence, and it is incredibly important to protect that presumption given the extraordinary power that the state and its organs can bring to bear on criminal defendants. I'm not saying that has to be done at the expense of crime victims. I don't think that's our position. But we have to bear in mind that when you're talking about life and liberty, and we are in Pennsylvania in many instances, because we have capital punishment here on the books right now, we have to be very, very careful about ensuring those rights. And so I think while I was engaged to work for the League of Women Voters on this particular case, it wouldn't surprise me to say that or to hear that they actually are aligned with the ACLU on the importance of the presumption of innocence.
So that is a yes.
Protecting criminal defendants' rights.
So that is a yes.
Yeah, I think so.
Stephen Bizarre was the counsel for the Pennsylvania League of Women Voters in this case that Commonwealth Court threw out of Marcy's Law. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for your program. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, the United Way of Pennsylvania has just released a study on Pennsylvanians who are working full-time but are not able to afford the essentials like food, rent, mortgages, those kind of things. The pandemic, this is coming, you know, we talked about this a few years ago, research from the United Way. But during the pandemic, things have changed even for the worse for many people. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. The paradox of long-term care staffing shortages amid reports of high unemployment is not lost on long-term care workers and administrators. With plenty of jobs available in the industry, one health administrator is asking how it is that the long-term care industry can meet needs so much help and the rest of the world is unwilling to provide it. Erin Vialli is a senior professional in human resources and a licensed nursing home administrator based in Pittsburgh. She's on the program with us today. And also Zachary Schamberg, president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association. Erin Vialli, you wrote a column called "When Do We Get Our Rosie the Riveter Moment?" What did you mean by that?
So I am an administrator of a 197-bed facility in Pittsburgh. And as 2020 came to a close, I kept hearing about unemployment benefits ending. And what was this going to mean for 12 million Americans? How were they going to pay their bills? What were they going to do? And I couldn't help but think that that story was getting so much attention. And I didn't think that our story was getting much attention at all, that we were having a staffing crisis throughout the year of how we were going to cover our shifts, get work done in our facilities. So it just kind of, I called it the pandemic paradox. How could this be that in my world, we're having a staffing crisis, but in the larger world, there's an unemployment crisis?
Why do you think that paradox exists, that at a time when so many people are out of work and need jobs, that they're not coming and looking to work in the long-term care industry?
It's hard work that we do. It's very difficult. And this year, more so than any year, we, you know, these jobs in our facilities are physically demanding, mentally demanding, and this year have been so emotionally demanding. While our patients weren't able to have visitors, our staff have been a shoulder to lean on, someone to cry with, someone to hug. There's been so much anxiety, as I'm sure you can understand, among our patients. So our staff have really stepped up to be there for them. And these are just very difficult jobs. So I think that my job and Zach from the PhDA is doing a great job of trying to spread the word of how rewarding it can be to work in this industry, because I think people have an idea that it is just very hard without realizing how rewarding it is.
But during the pandemic, what's been different during the pandemic? I mean, one thing obviously is that your workers have had to be concerned about their own safety. But is there anything or what has been different during the pandemic as far as workforce?
Everything has been different. It has been, we had a staffing crisis prior. You know, there is a nursing shortage. It was already a struggle to fill some of these jobs, and the pandemic only exacerbated that. I'm very fortunate to work for ManorCare, which is part of the ProMedica company, and we were able to get so many resources. They made funds available for bonuses, to get contract agency staff in when we needed them. We had lots of resources from them. We had lots of resources from the PhDA. Zach and his team kept us abreast of the changes, which were daily. They updated our policies and our requirements and regulations very frequently. So that was a big difference for us. You know, testing at my facility, we were conducting 500 COVID tests every week. Just until this week was the first time we were able to cut back based on county positivity. So everything that we've done has gotten harder this year.
How many positive cases have you had in your facility?
Throughout since last May, we've had 57.
What about staff?
24.
By the way, if you have a question or a comment for our guest today, talking about long-term care and staffing shortages in long-term care, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@wytf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalk. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Zach Stamberg, who is president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, representing long-term care facilities. Zach, we have spoken fairly often during this pandemic because from the very beginning, long-term care facilities have been hit hard by the pandemic. It took some time here in Pennsylvania to get to that and to get the help you need. And we're going to talk a little bit about what help is still needed. But we've often talked about the staffing issue. And I think that Aaron mentioned it as well, that this was an issue that existed before the pandemic, in that you often, many facilities had trouble finding workers. Pay is not that great. It is hard work. It can be physically demanding. So let me put it this way. I think it takes a special kind of person to work in your industry. As Aaron said, it can be rewarding, but at a time when people consider their own safety, doesn't that make it even more difficult? I mean, it sounds as if there are a lot of issues going on here, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Scott. And thanks again for having me on. And you said it, you know, we have talked numerous times throughout the last 11 months from the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And no matter what we choose to focus on, whether it's what long-term care needs, whether it's the vaccine rollout, we always seem to come back to this issue. Workforce comes up in every single conversation that we have. And, you know, Aaron mentioned it, you just mentioned it, that even before the pandemic began in February and March in 2020, our sector was facing what I'll say is the most dangerous workforce shortage in the history of long-term care. And even going back to 2019, our then Auditor General, as we've discussed, Eugene DePasquale, released a report that was called Who Will Care for Mom and Dad? And it highlighted those challenges, not just with retaining our staff in long-term care, but more importantly, recruiting and training new qualified staff as well. So as we've discussed, this pandemic has exacerbated, it has amplified our workforce crisis. I would go back to months ago when the pandemic began. We saw staff begin to leave because of the fear of COVID, because they didn't want to get sick or they didn't want their family members to get sick. And we understood that. When staff are leaving today, however, we are routinely hearing the same three words: fatigue, burnout, and exhaustion. Because between the challenge of protecting their residents every single day and then adhering to the endless state and federal guidelines that continue to be heaped on this industry, we are beginning to see that mass exodus that we've always feared take place. And that's very concerning moving forward.
When you say mass exodus, give me a sense of what that really means.
Sure. More and more, our industry is relying on agency staff, meaning contracted outside staff members who are coming in on a daily basis and filling in the positions that we just simply can't. We had to, at the very beginning of the pandemic, the first thing we did with the Wolf administration was work with them to ensure that our members would have the necessary staff in place. So that included allowing flexibilities in job training, easing bureaucratic burdens to bring workers from out of state, and as we've spoken about, even creating what's called a temporary nurse aide program, which is a brand new position in long-term care. So it's gotten to the point where, and I think it's a good thing that we've had to think outside the box to address the workforce crisis, but we've had to create new positions. We've had to lean on state and federal allies to help this industry bring more workers in, because we just don't have the pipeline available to ensure that not only can we care for folks today as we start to see the light at the end of the tunnel of the COVID-19 pandemic, but that we can't care for folks in the months and years to come, especially in the third oldest state in terms of our population in the entire country.
We have a question from Chris, who asks, what impact does the wage rate paid to long-term care workers have in hiring? If workers were found to be COVID positive, do they get 2 weeks paid time off to quarantine? Let's start with, there are two questions there, but let's start with wages. As I said, traditionally, the workers in your facilities are not making a lot of money. So is that a big factor in this? I mean, are there people who are looking at this and saying, especially now, that I could be risking my safety, my family's safety, and I'm not going to make it. It's hard work, and I'm not going to make a whole lot of money.
Yeah, of course. And let me tackle that first. So one is that for most of the providers that we represent, whether you want to call it hazard pay or heroes pay, those bonuses have been paid throughout the COVID-19 pandemic to keep folks coming to work and really to honor them for all that they were able to do to keep their fellow staff and their residents safe. But Scott, you bring up an interesting point, or it's the right point to address, and it's Chris's question, that wages haven't kept up. And wages haven't kept up with other service industries like Sheetz, like Wawa, as we continue to lose workers to those companies and those other industries. The question is why? Why haven't wages kept up? And it's because, as we've discussed before, of the Medicaid program. And right now, two-thirds of all of Pennsylvania's long-term care residents in nursing homes have their care paid for by the state's Medicaid program. But as you and I have discussed, we haven't seen a meaningful increase in Medicaid reimbursement in Pennsylvania since 2014. The reimbursement for Medicaid controls everything that a provider can do, the investments in staff, the investments in care, and the investments in the facilities. If Medicaid doesn't keep pace with rising costs, which on average are about 2% per year, that doesn't give providers the opportunity to increase those wages and invest in their staff. And that's going to lead to even more of a crisis when it comes to workforce.
But Zach, there are long-term care facilities that are nonprofit, and there are those that are for-profit facilities. The for-profit facilities, especially, why can't they just raise rates on their own, or raise pay on their own?
Well, again, when two-thirds of all long-term care residents in those nursing homes, whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit, when two-thirds of those residents are on Medicaid, and that is the single reliant payment for everything that a provider does. And again, I don't care if you're a for-profit or a not-for-profit facility. And it's important to note that for-profit facilities throughout Pennsylvania take the majority of Medicaid residents. They take more what I'll call Medicaid day one residents, meaning someone is discharged from the hospital or from their home to a nursing home. They are on Medicaid day one, when that is the single point of reimbursement for these providers, and it controls everything that they do in terms of those investments. And there's not ways to raise rates on other types of care or to have more reimbursement come in, then there isn't the opportunity to raise wages. There isn't the opportunity to invest in care. There isn't the opportunity, unfortunately, to invest in facilities. So really, at the end of the day, it all comes back to that Medicaid program and the investment that we choose to make or not make in it this year.
Aaron, second part of Chris's question, are workers, if they're found to be COVID positive, do they get 2 weeks off to quarantine, and are they paid during those 2 weeks?
Oh, yes. We ProMedica offers 14 days, so almost 3 working weeks for if you contract COVID or if you quarantine for other reasons due to an exposure. So, yes, of course, to keep our patients safe, you know, isolating anyone who may have been exposed, of course, is a priority for us and making sure that they get paid.
Another question from Abby at Millersville University. Are there education reimbursement incentives or partnerships with higher ed to help fill these open jobs?
Oh, great question, Abby. Yes, this is the best thing I think we can do in the long-term care industry is promote our own. So yes, ProMedica has fabulous tuition reimbursement. We have student loan repayment programs because growing our own nurses is the best thing we can do. We have such fabulous, fabulous CNA caregivers. And to the extent that we're able, we really want to motivate those people to go to nursing school to get that next level of education so that they can care for our patients in other ways.
Zach, we only have about a minute left. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. So you've called it a crisis, Zach. Where do we go from here? I mean, you say that we've had this mass accident. What's next? What has to happen?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, we need to make that long-term investment in long-term care that begins and ends with the state's Medicaid program. I think we need to encourage the state and to create more state policies to bring workers into long-term care. And that goes with an issue like a directive like loan forgiveness and creating less bureaucratic hoops to becoming a licensed nurse or an employee in long-term care. And at the end of the day, Scott, you know, we've spoken about it. Long-term care, specifically nursing homes, are the second most regulated industry in the United States. And the relationship between our providers on the front lines, like Aaron, and those who regulate them have to be improved. We have to make this a career that folks want to come to, an industry that folks want to come to. So collaboration has to take place.
Aaron Vialli and Zach Schamberg, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.